What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And John, we've been on a mission to educate people about fairness and about race relations, and we've done it on a number of different podcasts, and we will continue to do it. Because for those who think that American history has settled this issue in terms of fairness to African Americans and others, I beg to differ. And only because when you look at our history, it took us 100 years from the Civil War to get to a Civil Rights Act. And so to think that the period after the Civil War, okay, it's all done, we have freed the slaves, and everything's better now, or to think that in the last 50 years, everything that happened the preceding 300 years, let's just wipe that off the books and forget about it. It's not possible.
Well, I also think as we learned in another podcast, how the government was complicit in making white-only neighborhoods and forcing blacks into city, basically slums. I mean, so they directed it that way, which, you know, really shocked me.
Now, there is some dispute, as we found among scholars, about the role that the federal government played in all of this, but there's no denying that the federal government and state governments and local governments haven't done enough to encourage integrated communities, because to me, that solves a lot of problems. When you live next door, you begin to understand each other, fraternize. I mean, I hate that question that I still see on certain surveys. Do you have any friends of another color? And then people sit there scratching their heads saying, honestly, I only have one, or I don't have any.
Right.
And that's unfortunate. It really is.
Yeah, well, it is sad in this day and age to think about it, but we are still very much isolated.
Absolutely. And we live in the Northeast, and we like to think of ourselves as progressive, but in fact, we're anything but. And you're going to learn something about that, all of you, on this podcast. And the book that we are focusing on today is called Moving Toward Integration, The Past and the Future of Fair Housing. And John, that suggests if we're moving toward it, we're not there.
Well, I think obviously we're not there, but if we're moving toward it, that's at least a good direction.
But
to
there
be
are
going.
Some communities, as we learn, that are moving toward it with more pace, more determination.
Yes.
Others who are languishing and are laggards. And we live in a community where, frankly, I still see an awful lot of segregation. So we try to paper that over. Well, we have bad school results because we have all the poor kids, and many of whom are minorities in the cities. And whoever could have fled to the suburbs in our state has done that. And so we are left again with a very segregated situation, and busing or whatever we might do, some of these programs where you bus kids into the urban areas, these are all kind of false attempts to do what we should be doing, which is integrating housing, and then we don't have to do these other things.
Well, yeah, I think so. What might cure this is if we regionalize in our area, that may be at least a start in the right direction, but we'll see if There's a lot of talk, but we'll see what the politicians do.
Well, we're also going to talk about what the 1968 Fair Housing Act did. We'll talk about public housing, a whole range of issues that we are going to delve into with Richard H. Sander. And again, he and some colleagues have put forward this book called Moving Toward Integration. And you'll hear much more about it in this very interesting look at housing patterns and the impact that it has on the entire society, right now on America Trends. Joining us on America Trends is Richard Sander. He's an economist and professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, and he has co-authored a book called Moving Toward Integration, The Past and the Future of Fair Housing. And just to start our conversation, we did another podcast with Richard Rothstein talking about making certain that we could desegregate our housing in this country. And we were shocked to find out that the federal government was complicit in a lot of the segregation that we see still to this day in housing across America.
Yes, well, I disagree with Mr. Rothstein on many of his findings. I think his book is very important in highlighting housing segregation as a problem. It's too often been overlooked when we talk about different social problems in the U.S. But Rothstein, I think, engages too much in conspiracy theory. His book really implies that segregation existed because of concerted government actions. And we look much more carefully at the historical record than he does in his book and really don't find a lot of support for that argument. One has to distinguish, I think, between proactive efforts to create ghettos and how federal programs adapt to the existence of ghettos. So we don't see much effort by the federal government in particular to create ghettos. I don't think you can point to any large ghetto in the United States that was established through federal efforts. But once they existed in the 1920s and 30s, as federal programs came into existence, the administrators of those programs and the presidents who ran the administrations, I think, tended to view segregation as an accomplished fact, that they either had to choose not to do any assisted housing program at all or to do it within a segregated regime. So it's, in some ways a subtle distinction, but I think an important one.
But what about the federal government underwriting various forms of loans that brought people out to the suburbs and excluding blacks in various covenants? Do you believe that that really does reflect the truth?
Well, so restrictive covenants were created when the Supreme Court took cities out of the business of segregation. In the 1910s, there were a number of cities in the South that created racial zoning laws. And the U.S. Supreme Court declared in 1917 that those were unconstitutional. So then private owners started forming residential associations to essentially collectively agree that none of the signers would sell to African Americans. And courts enforced those, but they were driven by private action. And when the Supreme Court finally squarely addressed the issue in 1948, they ruled that restrictive covenant enforcement by courts was also unconstitutional. The government acted in remarkably principled ways, considering, you know, how much racial conflict there was in the U.S. at the time. The suburban issue, Rothstein sort of implies that blacks were completely excluded from these programs. And again, that's a great overstatement. Early federal agency called the Homeowners Loan Corporation was established in the early 1930s to help distressed properties that were going through foreclosure. And Rothstein implies that blacks could not participate at all. We actually find, several other scholars have found, that blacks participated on pretty comparable terms to those of whites, which again in the 1930s was no mean accomplishment. Now, it's true that the Federal Housing Administration, which started underwriting long-term loans in new developments, mm-hmm. primarily did operate in suburbs. But that, you know, again, is explained by the fact that most of the new housing in a segregated urban area was going to be occupied by whites. In other words, in a world where restrictive covenants existed, blacks were generally not able to move to suburban housing. So the FHA had a choice. Can we either not have this program at all, or do we have a program that's going to have significant segregative effects? So I think that, you know, the story is complex. The federal government accommodated segregation in many ways. Some of its actions probably made segregation worse. But it also was pretty early on trying to move things in a direction of more equal opportunity. And eventually they really achieved that in the 1960s.
Well, let's talk about the Fair Housing Act, because one of your co-authors, Jonathan Zasloff, wrote, on its 50th anniversary, the Fair Housing Act remains the most spectacularly successful disappointment in civil rights history. Unpack that for us.
Sure. So the Fair Housing Act was passed in April of 1968. We just passed the 50th anniversary. And it had two objectives. One was to try to combat housing discrimination, referring to how people are actually treated in the marketplace when they go out and look for housing. The other goal was to try to reduce housing segregation. Segregation means how are people distributed within a metropolitan area. So in the 60s, both discrimination and segregation facing African Americans were very intense. The provisions of the act focused on discrimination. In other words, it made it illegal for people to discriminate in the private market and empowered the Justice Department to bring suit against operators that did that. And the Justice Department did a pretty good job. Remarkably, some of their best work happened under the Nixon and Ford administrations when a Justice Department official named Frank Schwelb became head of the housing section of the Justice Department. And he orchestrated a lot of very strong enforcement actions. So housing discrimination levels fall by about two-thirds between the late 1960s and the late 1970s. So I think that's a pretty impressive success, especially when you think about sort of how decentralized housing decisions are in America.
Mm-hmm.
But segregation was a different matter. So we measure segregation on a scale of 0 to 100 using something called the Index of Dissimilarity.
Yeah, I'd like you to explain that. So if somebody is going to dive deep into your book, they have a basic explanation of that indices.
Yeah, on this index, 100 represents complete apartheid, and 0 represents complete integration. And most ethnic groups in America have, you know, indexes, say, in the 20s to the low 40s. If you look at Italian Americans or Jewish Americans or Chinese Americans, they're all somewhere in that range. Whereas African Americans in the 60s had in our largest cities an average dissimilarity index of 92. So very close to apartheid, really.
Mm.
In the 20 years after the Fair Housing Act, that average fell from 92 to around 80 or 79. Not much progress, really. But if you look at it in more detail, you see two patterns. You see some cities that actually fell quite a bit, down into the high 60s, and other cities that only declined a little bit into the mid-80s. So we really have changed from a situation where every place was highly segregated to one where we now have some integrated success stories, but a lot of major cities like New York and Philadelphia and Chicago that are still quite intensely segregated.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
When we look at different sectors of the country, I know we are, here in the Northeast, and we still see just an awful lot of segregation in terms of our small inner cities, particularly in the state of Connecticut, where we are now podcasting from. It's really so dramatic.
In some ways, the effects of segregation have gotten worse, because what happened in the 60s and 70s is that areas that remained segregated had a lot of, you know, you still had many, many blacks moving out of the old ghettos. But in places like New York and Chicago and Philadelphia, they moved into neighborhoods that were adjacent to existing black concentrations. And so what you had was a sort of a series of dominoes. You had neighborhoods that would be briefly integrated and then resegregate because many, many blacks were moving in and relatively few whites were moving in. So at the end of the day, you had many more neighborhoods that were available to blacks to live in, but the segregation was still very high. And you had this added dimension where middle-class blacks were now sort of in newer housing further from the central city. Low and moderate-income blacks were concentrated in the old ghettos. So translation of segregation as an experience for working-class blacks became one of much more concentrated poverty and more concentrated deprivation of various types. So in the segregated cities, you've actually seen a lot of fairly steady erosion of many black indicators. Unemployment levels have gradually crept up. Median income levels have stagnated or fallen. So in many dimensions, all these effects, these phenomena have become worse. Whereas in integrated metropolitan areas, some examples are Seattle or San Diego, San Antonio. These are all areas where the segregation index is now down in the 60s or even the 50s. And all of those areas have seen dramatic improvements in black outcomes across the board. So in San Diego, black unemployment is only about 20% higher than white unemployment, whereas in Chicago and Philadelphia, it's like 250% higher. Even outcomes like mortality rates and test scores have shown much smaller black-white disparities in these integrated cities than in the segregated.
Well, it sounds like a lot of the cities that didn't have a long history of segregation or trying to make accommodation and trying various policies that perhaps did not work, like public housing or whatever, that in fact some of these newer areas that you talk about in the West just didn't have the baggage of history. Is that accurate?
I think that's part of it. A lot of what we try to do in the book is really disentangle this, and we end up being able to explain it almost entirely. So it's partly that kind of growth. One of the things that's very important in the 70s and 80s is that you have these fair housing laws on the books now. Discrimination is falling. How much dynamism is there in black mobility? In places like San Diego or Seattle, population's increasing rapidly. Their economies are booming during those decades. They're attracting lots of migrants from other parts of the country. So an African-American relocating, say, from Chicago to San Diego is very likely to say, there are fair housing laws now. I can live wherever I want. I don't need to sort of go into the black core to find housing. So those migrants are very likely to end up in predominantly white neighborhoods. And once you have a substantial number of migrants like that, that changes everyone's perception of how the market's working. Blacks who live in inner city San Diego, and there were very segregated neighborhoods in those cities before 1970, those residents are now seeing many different white neighborhoods that are integrated. So they start moving into those neighborhoods in larger numbers. But those neighborhoods are sufficiently dispersed that you don't get any resegregation there like you do in the old segregated cities. So this dynamism, the population growth that happened in the West, was clearly very important. But interestingly, the South experienced much more integration than the North did. And that sort of goes against this idea, right? Because they had the biggest burden of history. What's going on there is that the Southern cities start benefiting from reverse migration from the North exactly when fair housing laws start coming into play. So in the 70s and 80s, Chicago is basically getting no new black migrants, but Atlanta and Nashville and Tallahassee are getting lots of new black migrants. So that creates that sort of dynamism in those areas and produces a lot of integrated suburbs.
So the Northeast, is it now an outlier in many ways?
The Northeast and the Midwest are both the places where segregation is the worst. There, you know, some southern cities have been kind of bypassed by the Sun Belt revival. And so, like Memphis, for example, has not seen nearly the dynamism that Nashville has. So they're a little bit more in that old city pattern. The thing is that an awful lot of African Americans still live in those older cities. Migration has rebalanced things somewhat, but the vast majority of urban African Americans are still in places that are pretty segregated.
The book is called Moving Toward Integration. One of the co-authors is with us, Richard Sander, and we're talking about the past and the future of fair housing. You make the point very dramatically in the book that housing segregation is the most important factor driving racial inequality. Now, I know that there are a number of people who've said, well, the civil rights issue of the 21st century is education and greater opportunities and equity and the like. But isn't that tied directly to housing?
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's been a big challenge for contemporary civil rights. You know, we have a lot of focus in the nation, especially I think in the last 3 or 4 years, on the issue of racial inequality. But many of the solutions, much of the discussion sort of focuses on very specific things like police behavior or outcomes in inner city schools and things like that. So in the book, we're trying to say, is there some underlying thing that drives these other factors much more than the reverse? And we really do find that housing segregation is that thing. So to take education as an example, we invested a lot of political capital and effort in the 60s and 70s in trying to desegregate public schools and also put a lot more federal money into the schools. And that was a success in some ways. I mean, there were improvements in test scores, and many southern cities had much more integrated schools afterwards. But because housing remained segregated, even in places where you had school busing, the schools gradually reverted back to very segregated patterns. So in the 21st century, we still have, you know, educational gaps and problems just about as severe as they were in the 1970s. Whereas in these cities that have actually achieved housing integration, like San Diego, for example, you have integrated schools that follow as a matter of course. In other words, since people tend to go to neighborhood schools, if the housing's integrated, then the schools will be. And if the housing is integrated, we also find school integration's a lot more meaningful. In other words, students are actually really forming friendships across racial lines. They're less likely to sort of be stratified into high-achieving and low-achieving classes. The individual classes are more integrated. And what we, you know, most encouragingly see is that black test scores really start going up very sharply in those schools that have that are in integrated neighborhoods. So the ultimate goal here, I think, in terms of education reform, is to raise educational performance and close racial gaps. And housing integration seems to be the path to do that.
What are the creative approaches that are now being taken in cities, states, and even at the federal level to take your research and research that others have done and really apply it, recognizing that some of these efforts to make certain that educational attainment is going to be greater among minority groups has really, as you say, run into a dead end because it's not real, it's manufactured. This is so much more real.
Yeah, and it's going to be an interesting challenge to see how fair housing policy evolves. I mean, you know, the late Obama administration had as one of its important achievements a recognition that a direct focus on integration should be part of what cities are doing when they receive federal aid. That mandate has been under pretty steady assault from Ben Carson under the Trump administration, and it's currently in court to see how far these regulations can be rolled back. Regardless of whether or not that happens, I think it's really important that we have a broader public discussion that includes housing integration. Surprisingly, you know, a lot of Democrats, I think, are nervous about stepping forward and saying housing integration should be a specific goal. There's still, I think, a lot of feeling that school busing cost many people their political careers and didn't work. And so what I'm hoping is that leaders in politics will recognize that there really is a more durable way of going about this. And there are housing integration strategies that we can use that take advantage of the market, that take advantage entirely of voluntary choice, and yet can really change these patterns of segregation.
But honestly, Professor Sander, I haven't heard anyone talking about this issue in the longest time, and that's why we thought it would be really important to bring this issue forward. But there are many analysts and policymakers who seem to have given up on this notion. And yet, when you look at educational outcomes, when you look at net worth, I mean, without having the ability to own a home in a good neighborhood, blacks in our society are not going to move forward in a material way, I don't think.
That's right. So in segregated areas, for example, black housing prices tend to lag behind the white market, whereas in the integrated metro areas, blacks not only increase their home ownership rates, but their homes appreciate in tandem with the white market. So it's an engine of so many different things. And I think, you know, I think there are two things that have to happen. One is a broader public awareness of these dramatic benefits that result from housing integration. And, of course, that's one reason we wrote the book. And the second is realizing that there are mechanisms that really can command political support across a broad spectrum. So let me give you one example. Chicago does have one area that's quite integrated, and that's the village of Oak Park, right on the western border of Chicago. And the way Oak Park did it is that they created a counseling center that gathers information on housing market opportunities and essentially acts as a clearinghouse where people can come and get very sophisticated counseling. They find out what people are looking for when they're thinking about moving. They give them a lot of options, and they make sure that they're really aware that they really consider integrated options. So that can involve giving them tours, introducing them to particular home sellers or apartment owners, really trying to smooth the path so that people consider housing that they might not ordinarily consider. And it's had really effective results. So that's something that, you know, I it's hard to imagine any political leader really saying that that's a bad thing or what do they call social engineering. When it certainly has a social goal behind it, but it's really maximizing choice.
Well, you note that liberals tend to emphasize discrimination, racism, as explanations for what's going on and the continued segregation. And then conservatives usually accentuate the role of personal preferences and self-segregation. It would seem as if both of these groups just don't quite have it right.
Yes, and that's one reason that I complained a little bit about Richard Rothstein earlier in the interview, because Rothstein is doing a great service by making segregation a more visible problem, but he so relentlessly argues that it's a manifestation of white racism that I think that can really have a boomerang effect, because if you think about it, blacks who hear that message are going to say, well, maybe I shouldn't move into a white neighborhood because I'm just going to encounter a lot of racist people. And whites are going to say, well, it's not racism. I'm not racist. So I just am going to reject that entire argument. I think understanding history in a more nuanced way and seeing that we actually have made steady progress and that there are a lot of people of goodwill and a lot of interest in integration across racial lines, I think all those things are really important ingredients to solving these problems. So we need a less polarized dialogue about this stuff. We need to really see housing integration as a constructive goal that people of all persuasions should rally around.
What would persuade you that some of these light-touch incentives and information to promote integration aren't working over the next 15 or 20 years? And frankly, when you look at the federal government and the movement these days, it may be even more backsliding than we've seen in the recent period. What would make you think that maybe we've got to look at this again if we are going to create the outcomes that I think all of us would like to see in our society? And it has so many impacts on education, perhaps crime, a whole relative index of activity. So what would convince you that maybe these light touch incentives are not enough?
I think we need to try the light touch incentives. I mean, I'm not at all complacent about what we should do. Things like the Oak Park Housing Center are wonderful examples, but they're not going to spring up nationwide on their own. We really have to make this an important national goal. One thing that I think we ought to do is something called Race to the Top, where we have a national competition and invite metropolitan areas to form integration councils and develop plans for integrating their areas, and then provide funding for those that go furthest in articulating what they can do, and provide significant funding. Although I think on the whole, these integration strategies are really, really cheap compared to many social initiatives, and provide accountability by measuring how segregation falls over time. You know, what's nice about housing segregation and integration is that we can really track progress pretty precisely, and we know that these measures like the index of dissimilarity really do correlate with improved outcomes. So it's not too hard to maintain accountability, and I think that's an important ingredient for success.
When we look at gentrification, it's a term that gets a lot of application in our urban settings these days. We did a piece on Brooklyn, New York, and the changes that have gone on there, and yet there are still some enclaves where the poor congregate. I mean, is gentrification really an important part of this story?
It is a very important part, I think. So for one thing, we can't have metropolitan-wide integration if we don't have migration in both directions. All the areas that have become more integrated, blacks move into non-black areas, but the reverse migration happens too. So gentrification's important in that sense because it represents the willingness of racially diverse people to move into central cities and try to raise housing quality in deteriorated neighborhoods. The dark side of gentrification, of course, is if it's very concentrated, and it leads to such an escalation in housing prices that it displaces all the people who are originally in the neighborhood. And I think there are two responses to that. One is to realize that that doesn't happen as often as thought. There are certainly many neighborhoods nationwide where that has happened. But if you look at the average gentrification outcome in America, it's much more frequently a fairly gradual process, and displacement doesn't happen on a very large scale. Still, I think the other thing to keep in mind is that there are ways of intervening in places where the displacement really is happening. So in the book, we talk about the idea of housing trusts, of using a pool of funds to identify neighborhoods where gentrification is taking off and buy properties that provide low and moderate income housing, put those properties into a deed restriction that limits the rate of rent increase on the properties, and then put them back into the private market. So through that, you can pretty inexpensively shield a large proportion of the housing in a gentrifying neighborhood from really intense gentrifying pressures. And that helps to ensure that the neighborhood's going to remain integrated, and it also tends to make gentrification more diffuse. Because it can't completely flip neighborhood A, you're going to have more gentrification spreading to neighborhood B and C nearby.
Is that happening in many locales?
Yes, in places where this housing trust idea has been deployed, I think it has been effective. So I think it has a lot of potential. And, you know, again, the big picture is that we need gentrification just like we need more suburbanization of inner-city residents to really create balanced living patterns across metro areas. Everyone benefits when, for example, their proximity to work is not determined by what race they are, but sort of by where they work and where it's convenient to live.
In closing, when we look at the changes demographically in America, in addition to African Americans, the growing number of Latinos, and the sense that millennials really are just not as color conscious as we might have been growing up, put that into the mix for us.
So for Hispanics, segregation is certainly an issue and a problem, but I think a much more tractable one than for African-Americans. Hispanics, on the whole, are following a much closer pattern to what we saw with, say, Italian-Americans in the early 20th century. A lot of high Hispanic segregation is driven by recent immigration. So someone who's just arriving from a Latin American country is likely to go to a Spanish-speaking neighborhood and you know, in a sense, thrive from the fact that there are lots of neighbors who can help give them cultural guidance on adapting to America and learning English and so on. Middle-class Hispanics tend to move in large numbers into integrated neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods tend not to resegregate. So I think over time we'll see Hispanic segregation largely correct itself. So, you know, there might be some room for initiatives, but it's much less of a really durable, persistent and harmful problem than it is for African Americans. Remind me of the second.
Millennials and their lack of concern about color and really living among each other and really intermarrying more. Do you see that as something that will perhaps ameliorate some of the issues we're talking about?
Yes, I think the millennial attitudes toward race are encouraging and helpful. And we certainly see that they are often pioneers in gentrification and, as you say, have higher racial intermarriage rates and so on. But what's important to keep in mind is that with African-American segregation, there really is a very persistent core. It's kind of a market failure. in these cities that have very high segregation. And that won't be changed simply by growing tolerance and a greater willingness to live in integrated areas. I really think that we need attentive public policies that are really trying to stimulate paths towards integration. So even with greater racial tolerance, there is still, I think, an indispensable role for public policy in solving this problem.
Moving toward integration, the past and future of fair housing, and one of the co-authors of this book, Richard H. Sander, with us today on America Trends. Thank you so much for coming by.
Yeah, thank you for the conversation.